History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. We've learned they don't have to go untold as long as we're willing to take a little initiative and ask a few questions and then invest enough time to listen patiently as memories from long ago take on new meaning in the here and now. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along that journey, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we find ourselves inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Our guest today is 100 years old, soon to turn 101 in Rio Rancho, New Mexico. He served in the Pacific as a Navy corpsman with the Marine Corps during World War II, but we always like to go back to the beginning. Bill DeGeneres is our guest today. And Bill, you told me you moved to Southern California when you were 5, but you were born in Shreveport, Louisiana. You have any memories at all of those early years in northern Louisiana at the start of the Great Depression?
No. I was 6 years old. No, I don't remember much until I remember some of the trips. We took 2 or 3 trips to California. My dad was in business with his brother, and they had some disruption, something, and I heard that his brother pulled a gun on him. So that's when we left.
That sounds like a good reason to leave.
Yeah. So we came to California. In the old days, I remember some of the old roads, and we drove a Model T out here from Louisiana, and Dad carried extra boots for the tires, because I guess they had inner tubes, but he had to have a lot of repair stuff for that and boots to put in the tires. So a lot of the roads were gravel roads in those days. So it would take us a week to get to California. It was a long drive, but we made it. And Dad was a very industrious person, and he always found work. In fact, he went to work for MGM Studios soon after he got out here, because he met some friends that worked for MGM, and they sicked him into that. And he became a set painter at MGM. He painted a big sign up on top of the lion, running for Metro Goldwyn-Mayer. He painted that a couple of times too. But that's the kind of work that he did, and we did okay. Nothing great. We did okay, you know.
Well, I guess that's where you inherited your artistic ability, but I have to ask, does that mean you got to run into some movie stars here and there, or is there a famous film that he worked on the set for that you'd like to share?
I never could get in the studios. They won't let you in the studios unless you know somebody. So after I got out of the Navy, I worked a couple places. And then before I met my wife, I went to work for Hal Roach Studios. They're the ones that produced Amos and Andy and Laurel and Hardy. And My Little Margie was working when I worked there. That was another program. Because at the time when I went into Hal Roach Studios, I became a sign painter. We did what they call the credits for movies. We'd get the list of credits, and it was hand painting lettering on a white on a black background. That would be photographed and made into a display that moved over for the beginning credits and for the ending credits of a movie, you know. So we did that. And I didn't meet too many movie stars. Arthur Lake, met a few minor. I met Hedy Lamarr one time. Yeah. Oh, that's about it. Yeah. Yeah. I had to work a lot. So
I guess so. And I'm curious, you know, what it was like growing up, because there's so much Hollywood mystique, and even Venice Beach has its own mystique. But when you got to Venice, California, there in the late 1920s, and you grew up around there with your brother and your family, what was it like? What kind of stories can you tell us about those years?
Well, pretty quiet, really. Things were a lot different then. We had an electric railroad went from downtown all the way through Venice up to Santa Monica, and they get to the other end. It was a big red train. I remember that. and you get to the end of the road, and there was no way of turning the train around. They did, the train engineer would go in and reverse the seats and the connection outside, and we'd just get on and turn around and sit down to go back to Los Angeles or to somebody go back to Santa Monica. So other than that, the beach was the big excitement in those days, and that's why I'm suffering now with so many skin cancer. The sun burned me up. But I became a surfer. I had a group of people. We became a little company of surfers called Venice Paddleboard Club. And we used to go up and down the coast with that. And I spent a lot of summers with a bunch of buddies. We'd do a lot of surfing, and we'd have parties at the beach. Things was really great. In those days, traffic was nothing along the highway. I mean, you could go for half an hour and not see anybody. Not exactly, but I mean, it was so quiet. It was wonderful living in those days. You know, we had three theaters in along the beach: Venice, Ocean Park, and Santa Monica, and we had the piers. In fact, I worked on Venice Pier for a while I was in school. Worked at the Fun House, what they call it. And I worked in a place where they threw baseballs at milk bottles, knocked that over. Yeah. So, and I was working 15 cents an hour in those days. So it was good days. I enjoyed a lot of it, you know, really good. And I did well in school until, no problem, you know, other than getting my nose bled a couple of times. But, you know, it was really, I enjoyed it. I look back on it now, and it was nice. We had boyfriends and girlfriends, and we got together in parties and just got together and yak and go to the movies and the Dome Theater or the Venice Theater or the Maralta. Good days. I really enjoyed it.
Do you remember, I know this a long time ago, but do you remember as a boy having this idea, this dream or ambition of, hey, when I grow up, this is what I want to be or what I want to do?
I always thought I'd get into artwork. Because I did well in high school with the art. I had art classes every year, especially, and I had a good art teacher, Mrs. Finley, that helped me a lot. And I had a poster that I made for the San Francisco World's Fair. I think that was 1939, and I did a poster for that, and it was accepted and displayed at the World's Fair there. And then the school got it after that. And what they did with it, I don't know. But did well in artwork, and just had fun, that's all.
It may still be at Venice High School somewhere, and I understand you've got a painting at the Smithsonian we're going to hear about later. But I am curious when you realized that was something you were good at, because I've noticed a lot of people that are really talented in art don't realize they're as good as they really are. When did you figure out that you had this natural gift or talent?
Well, it was a natural, and it was developed by help from, like, my art teacher and there. And then when I went to college at Santa Monica City College, the art teacher there helped me a lot, too. And so I liked it, and I didn't think of at the time of really what I wanted to do financially about that. I just hoped I could find something that would develop me, which I did, but it was my own doing. I wasn't pushed very much. It was a need, you know, a need for money. It was something I always liked to do, and I didn't have any problem with it.
I want to ask you about December 7th, 1941, but you were already in the Navy at that point. Before we get to that date, there are a couple other things that happened in Southern California that other veterans have told me about that I'm wondering if you have a memory of. There was, of course, the Olympics that came to Los Angeles in 1932. But before that, or right around the same time, I guess, the Long Beach earthquake, I've heard, was pretty significant. Did you have any particular memories of either of those things?
Nothing around 1932. I don't remember much around there. But I remember the earthquake. In fact, my mother and I, we were down in Venice, right where the beginning of the Venice pier was, and we were walking up to the pier. I guess we were going to go up, get something to eat or something, hot dog or something. But things started really swaying. I mean, there was strung lights across the, the avenue that goes up to the pier. And my mother would kind of panicked a little bit, you know, and I grabbed her. I said, just get in the middle of the street, stand still, you'll be okay. And we looked over and we saw brick falling, hit a bus. There was a street that went close to the pier that went parallel to the ocean. And this bus was coming through, and it went by this one big building. And we saw just a few brick falling off and hitting the top of the bus there. You know, but that was the only outstanding thing that I remember about that earthquake. We did have another one at one time. I went with my mother again to we were at the Dome Theater in Ocean Park, and we were sitting in the balcony there watching a movie, and things started swinging around, you know. My mother started to jump up, you know, so I had to hold her down. But that was my experience with earthquakes. Nothing bad, but a little memorable, I should say.
I can tell. That's been a lot of years, and the memory is still very clear. And I mentioned you went in the Navy before Pearl Harbor, about 9 months before Pearl Harbor. Absolutely. You hadn't finished high school yet. You're 17 years old. What was your motivation? Why did you make that decision?
Well, my dad had been in the Navy in World War I. We'll get to that later, because he was, again, in the Navy during World War II. And he was a chief pharmacist's mate, and he did a lot of traveling in the Philippines and all in the Orient there and aboard ship. And it was very exciting to think about going out and seeing all things, other parts of the world, you know, and being aboard ship. And I kind of, in the back of my mind, always had thought I would like to do what my dad did. He didn't retire from the Navy. But my dad was born in 1898, and he went in when he was about 17, I think. And he stayed until the end of the war. I always enjoyed him telling me about some of the stuff. And in fact, he got tattoos, and I thought, no, God, I never want tattoos. He had tattoos all over his chest and his arms, you know. A tiger and a lady up across his chest. I remember that, and I thought, no, I'll never do that. But I did, when I went in the Navy. So that was my one reason I wanted to join, and I felt like I just needed something to happen. I wasn't happy in the 12th grade. And my brother graduated a semester, I guess, before I would have, and he joined the Army. That was in 1940, I guess. He joined the Army, and he got basic training into the Air Force right away. But I just made up my mind I wanted to go and join the Navy, and I told Mom and Dad that's what I wanted to do. And Dad was, of course, let the kids go, you know. And so, but I did. I enlisted, and I got my high school diploma within the first few months in the Navy. So they got it for the schooling that I went to in the Navy. My mother helped pick that up for me. So there I was in the Navy. What am I going to do now? So I wanted to go. When you get out of basic training in the Navy, they give you three options of different schoolings if you want to do when you get out of basic training, out of that. And I told them, I wanted to be an aviation machinist mate, an aviation machine mate, or a medical corpsman. So they sent me to the medical corps school. So that's what started. And it was okay because I liked it after I got into it. It was my same thing my dad did. And I stayed with that, of course, till the end of my service time.
Do you remember any moments in training that stood out that either were trying or made you chuckle a little bit? Because we hear a lot about the, you know, combat and everything that is in the movies, but sometimes there are things that aren't depicted that still stand out in your memory.
No, really, it was not a hard time. Then I enjoyed, in fact, we worked hard, did a lot of marching and bayonet exercises and flag training. The only thing is, at times I got bored, and I remember a drill instructor one time came over to me, you know, pull up your damn pants. That was a basic. Nothing really exciting happened. It was pretty good. We ate good, slept good, and I made friends while I was in the service there. And towards the end of it, I did fine. And when, on graduation, I got a notice to go to medical corps school at the Naval Hospital. So that was what they transferred me to be in my training for medical corpsman.
That would put him on the path to becoming a Marine's best friend. But America wasn't even in the war yet. When we come back, what does 100-year-old Bill DeGeneres remember about December 7th, 1941? Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 1,800 veterans will have seen their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes. Celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with 100-year-old Bill DeGeneres of Rio Rancho, New Mexico, a Navy corpsman who served with the Marines in the Pacific. But we aren't quite there yet in his storyline. We're about to hear his memories of December 7th, 1941. But in just thinking about that topic, I want to make sure I take a moment here to honor Lou Conter, who passed away this last week at the age of 102. Lou was the last living survivor of the sinking of the USS Arizona at Pearl Harbor. He carried that mantle so well, always honoring and remembering his 1,177 shipmates who were killed on that day of infamy. And with Lou's passing, it is certainly the end of an era. In a few years, we won't have any Pearl Harbor survivors still with us. With Lou's passing, there is no one left who was aboard the Arizona on December 7th, 1941. Our prayers are with Lou Conter's family, as well as the countless people he impacted in decades as an ambassador for his fellow survivors. We're going to jump back into Bill DeGeneres' World War II story and get his memories of that fateful day. When we left off, Bill, you had gone to San Diego Naval Hospital for training to become a Navy corpsman. So is that where you were on December 7th, 1941?
Well, I was at the Naval Training Station then, because after the Naval Hospital, I was transferred to the training station in San Diego there. And I worked in the war. I did a lot of war duty, and I did a lot of inoculation duty of new recruits who'd come in and give them their shots, you know, just stand up and get one arm and do two there, the other arm do a couple of that. But I did that for quite a while. In fact, between that and war duty was my whole career in at the Naval Training Station there after the hospital. And while I was at the Naval Training Station, I also saw there was an ability to go to dental school at the Naval Training Station. So I opted for that, and I stayed with that. I think it was about 6 weeks, and they transferred me to the dental clinic at the hospital there. And I was working with that until I got my orders from the Marine Corps. Baby, you're going to be a Marine now. So that was when I was transferred to Camp Elliott.
I'm just curious. I mean, your memory of the earthquake was so clear. December 7th was a geopolitical earthquake that we're still feeling the effects of. Yeah, do you have a memory of that day and how the news came to you?
Oh, yes, yes. I had been home on leave from the on Liberty, so to speak. Saturday, and we like we did every time I come to LA, when I went partying with friends and dancing and having a good time. And I was Sunday morning was December the 7th. I was fast asleep, and some friend of mine came over banging on my door. Get up now, what do you want? You know, don't bother me, I'm tired. But he told me the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, and you got to get back to your base immediately. So I knew that. So I jumped on that, and I guess I had breakfast and everything, and I left. And what I usually did on the weekend to go back to San Diego, I stick my thumb out there on the 101 highway to San Diego, and there was hundreds of guys along the road there looking for roads or a ride. But I found a ride and got into the at the Naval Hospital at the time, and it was in an upheaval, and quickly they assembled us. And assembled everybody out on the drill field. Uh-huh. And the captain gave us a big speech about, he was really excited, I can remember that. And some of the guys around me were really excited. A couple were crying, oh. And so the speech that the captain gave us was, we don't know what's happening now, so in so many words. There may be enemy out offshore, so we have to militarize the whole base. We were all given a rifle if we needed, and I was assigned to a barracks like other people. We stayed with people there, and I carried my medical equipment for bandaging and stuff like that. So that was for 2 or 3 days till they quieted down, found out the Japanese weren't coming in yet, but they still had a problem out at Pearl. I stayed there until I was drafted back into the Marine Corps.
And that was at the hospital or the training center?
That was at the training center, yeah.
I'm really glad you shared that, because so often we talk about the things that happened. We don't realize what almost happened. And I've heard so many stories from people in Southern California at that time that there was a real palpable fear that the Japanese were coming to California.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah, we didn't know. Nobody knew. I mean, there was no traffic between the States and Pearl except for wireless, I guess. Mm-hmm. So that was the only information they had. And of course, they didn't know in Pearl what the Japanese were going to do. They had just had to sit and wait and try to pick up what they got to protect the island, you know. And of course, all the National Guard and what army that was in the States patrolled all the coast, and immediately they turned out all the lights at nighttime, and anybody could be arrested for driving a car with the lights on, you know. So it was kind of exciting.
Yeah, and you said when they took you all out there on the parade grounds and lined you up and gave you that speech, you said some of your fellow sailors were excited, some of them were crying. What about you? How did you feel about this big news and this big change in the world and your world?
Like any other body was, I was pretty nervous about it. You know, what's going to happen, you know? I just accepted the way things were, and I didn't get too excited about it, but, you know, I was nervous. What's going to happen now? And it was a feeling that happened right at the time when the right after the Pearl Harbor, and everybody's all excited, you know. But we calmed down a while and went on routine when they found out no invasion was coming. So we just consolidated what we were doing right then and went back to work. That's all.
And just one thought comes to mind, and you may not know because you're not her, but have you ever thought about what it was like for your mother through the war? Because here for basically the whole war, she's got one son flying bombers and then fighters in Europe, and then you're out in the Pacific with the Marines at several battles where a lot of guys were killed. How do you think she handled all of that?
Gee, I think she did pretty well. She was affiliated with the Eastern Star, which is part of the Masonic, which my dad was a 32nd degree Mason. And, of course, at that time, he was home working at the studios, and she got along pretty well, I think. We wrote quite often, and I could still come to Los Angeles after Pearl Harbor, before I was transferred to the Marines. And she took everything pretty well. And Dad, you know, he'd been through wartime before, and he was gung-ho. He wanted to go back in, I know. So he was quite a character, really a nice guy, and a very, very smart person. And, of course, he went back in the Navy in 43, I think it was. Mm-hmm. And, but all that time, my mother did very, very well. She's still working she never worked, but you know, she was with the Eastern Star and ladies' clubs, and she did well. And we all, my brother and I and Dad, all contributed to her welfare, even all during the war. So she did very well, really.
Yeah, both sons and her husband off at war. And I've interviewed, you know, over 1,000 World War II guys like you. I think I can count on one hand the number who actually got to see their dad somewhere in uniform during the war. And we're going to hear that story from you. But tell me about, you know, the year or two right after Pearl Harbor. You get sent to be a corpsman with the Marine Corps. I haven't met a Marine yet who wouldn't lay down his life for a corpsman because he knows how many times he was saved. Tell me what happened next and how you got used to that new assignment.
Well, of course, I was a Marine, a Navy with the Marines, and I wore a Marine uniform with the arm insignia. I became a third class and then a second class, and later I got a first class petty officer while I was with the Marines. Being with the Marines, at first we went to, from San Diego Naval Hospital or Naval, the recruit depot, that is. We went into Camp Elliott, which was north of San Diego, which was a Marine base at the time in 1941 and 42. And at that time, they had taken over 144,000 acres in Oceanside, and they developed Camp Pendleton there at Oceanside. So we didn't stay long at Camp Elliott. They told us they were opening up Camp Pendleton, and we had to get up there, and the way we were going to get up there was walk. So that's the Marines, you know. Uh-huh. So we all loaded up. It was a whole 3rd Marine Division at the time was forming. And so we hiked. It took us, I think, 3 days to go up to Camp Pendleton and open the new barracks there and open everything and move in. And that was when we started training for overseas duty then. I went with the 3rd Special Weapons Battalion, Fleet Marine Force. And we had a 75-millimeter cannon mounted on a half track. We had two or three mounted 20-millimeter cannon that were partially shielded. And we had lots of 30 caliber and 50 caliber and other things that like training for hand grenade and that kind of. That was all at Camp Pendleton. That's what I did while I was there, and a lot of hiking. Oh, my God. In fact, the first day we went from Camp Elliott and landed, no, the first day into Camp Elliott from San Diego, I got with the Marines, and they said, suit up. You're going to go for a hike. And I was in my Navy uniform, and there's about 20 of us, and the Marines in their uniforms, and I'm trailing along for a 20-mile hike. I remember that. I remember that all good. And I was pretty tired by that. So
I imagine so.
That was the beginning of my experience with the Marines. Mm-hmm. Which was not bad. They're a bunch of good guys. I liked them, you know.
Well, I think Admiral Nimitz had a pretty famous quote about that, about the Marines in the Pacific, and uncommon valor was a common virtue. Your first deployment, your first trip overseas, from San Diego to where?
New Zealand. We went into Auckland, New Zealand. We landed there. That was in 42, I guess. We were going to not be stationed in Auckland. We gathered our outfit and a couple others, and they put us aboard a train, And the trains are a little bit different down there at that time. They were narrow gauge, smaller trains, but they were good. They were okay. So they took us 29 miles south of Auckland. I guess it's south, but it's down the island, and to a little town called Pukekohe. I remember that very, very vividly. And they, incidentally, New Zealand is a country of a lot of horse race tracks. So they put us on a horse race track, and they had already built a little cabins, a little two-man cabins all over the infield around there. And that's where I lived, in a two-man shack. They were okay. And in the main part, the officers and the mess hall and offices were in a bigger building that they stayed in in the same area. We stayed there, and then we stayed there for a while before we moved on out of there down into the Solomons.
Were there moments along the way, maybe one, maybe more than one, that really got your attention, that felt like a welcome to the war, this isn't a game kind of moment for you?
No, not really. We had a good time in New Zealand. Those were wonderful people. They invited us out to tea. In fact, the first experience with that, they invited me and another guy. They'd come out to camp, and we'd show them all of our weapons and everything and got to know them. And this one gentleman and his wife invited us out for tea to his house. My buddy and I, tea is going to be tea and crumpets or something. So we went into town, got a steak and eggs dinner, which was great, you know. Went out to their house, and we had another steak and eggs dinner. So that was a lot of fun, though, but we ate it. And, in fact, we took them a carton of cigarettes, and they had a hard time getting cigarettes at the time. And I took them a carton of our cigarettes, which I could buy for cost. I mean, it was like 15 cents a pack at the time. And they were delighted. So that was my experience with the people who. And we got to know them, and they were always nice people and very congenial. And on weekends, we'd take the train, go back up to Auckland, and go walk the streets and meet girls. They had a couple of dance halls where they tried to play American music. You know, it was altogether different, but a lot of fun, you know. And so I really didn't have any bad experiences in New Zealand at all. In fact, while we were there, we had a really nice captain of my company that I was with, and he took us on a motor trade down through several places in New Zealand. It was Rotorua, Tarango, and Pairo, which are several cities. And one of the cities has it's volcanic fumaroles or whatever they call them. The stuff that was really interesting to see. So that was part of my experience in New Zealand. Nothing bad, really, really good. Good eats, everything. You know, met a lot of friends.
Got to practice your Kiwi accent a little bit?
A little bit, and the hardest part is learning the monetary. I still can't remember all of it, but the best way to learn how to, what their equivalent money is worth is get into a poker game, you know. And when you lose, you find out how much you lost.
Some things you just have to learn the hard way. But it's one thing to lose a little money in a poker game. It's another thing altogether to lose a friend in battle. And eventually that would become part of Bill DeGeneres' experience as a Navy corpsman as well. If you'd like to explore some photos of this 100-year-old World War II veteran then and now, you can go to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we'll be right back after this. Ever feel like that dollar just doesn't go as far anymore? Well, join the club. Actually, you really should join the club. I mean, join the more than 350,000 members of EECU, the not-for-profit credit union now in 12 California counties. Free online and mobile banking, more than 30,000 co-op ATMs, and not just fair, but fantastic rates on auto loans, mortgages, and home equity lines of credit. Go to myeecu.org to become a member today, or just call this number, 1-800-538-3328. When times get tough and budgets get tight, a lot of businesses start slashing their marketing budgets, which all too often turns into a costly mistake.
Instead, what if you could customize that investment to zero in on your target audience with surgical precision? And why am I saying what if? Because I already know you can with Search Strategy Marketing. It's not about how much you spend, it's about the strategy behind it. And Search Strategy Marketing is ready to prove it to you with a free, no-obligation assessment of your current efforts. Learn how to outrank your competition with a free, customized action plan just for Hometown Heroes listeners. Just go to hometownheroesradio.com and click on that light bulb logo for Search Strategy Marketing. It doesn't matter what your business is, Search Strategy Marketing can lead you to the best way to connect with your customers. So look for that light bulb logo today at hometownheroesradio.com and plug into the power that can take your business to the next level.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors. And presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and today's conversation with 100-year-old Bill DeGeneres of Rio Rancho, New Mexico, where Hometown Heroes can be heard every Sunday morning at 9 on affiliate KIVA, known there as the Rock of Talk. Bill was born in Louisiana, spent most of his life in California. His duty as a Navy corpsman during World War II took him to places he never expected to see.
We went from New Zealand, got aboard ship in a bunch, and went to the Solomon Islands, and we landed on Guadalcanal, which was just had been secured just before we got there. So we didn't really have any bad things happen there except about every other night, we got what they call Sewing Machine Charlie. A plane would fly over our area and drop a couple of bombs. So we learned to dig foxholes there. And we were in a coconut grove there, and we also had to be careful of coconuts falling. But that was not a bad experience. We stayed there, and there was that's where I learned that my father was right across the bay from us in Tulagi. On the island of Tulagi, which was maybe the Solomon's Islands are a string of islands. I don't know, there must be a dozen or so islands. And this island was parallel to Guadalcanal, Tulagi, across the way. And my dad, we had been communicating by mail, and I found out his flotilla was over there. That was, he was aboard a converted World War I destroyer. They called them the old four stackers. Yeah. And it was called APD 17 or 19, I forget now. And after communicating, I had found out he was there, so I got permission to fly over there, not fly over, take a island, inter-island traffic over there. And I've met him and stayed with him a couple of times, and we watched the movies on his boat while we were there. It was very pleasant, you know. And then we got, I don't know how long we were there on Guadalcanal, maybe, a few weeks or a month or so. And we got orders that we were going to move up the slot, what they call it, to an island up there. And at the time, I didn't know who it was. But I told my dad, I wrote him a letter, we're going to be moving out and soon, and anyway, because we were getting all ready. And so he invited me to come see if I could get aboard his ship and go with him up there. You know, I didn't know it was going to be an invasion or we were just moving. So I asked my captain about that, you know, and he said, sure, if you want to go over there, go ahead with him, you know, take a little boat and go. Everything was pretty loose in those days. So I went aboard his ship, and a day later, we all got together and his ships got together, and there was LSTs and troop ships, I don't know, there was a few running parallel to go up the slot. We left in the evening, and it was, I guess it doesn't take too long to go up through there. in the middle of the night or early morning, still dark, we got general quarters. Everybody had to go out on deck. We all go out on deck and keep sailing. And I was on his ship there, you know. And pretty soon we hear these planes flying, you know, around. This plane went, looked up, the plane went past our fantail and went across because there was two lines of ships going up. About that time, the LST across the way, maybe 100 yards or more, opened fire all along. It looked like a blowtorch coming out. It hit that plane and knocked it down. Right, just, you know, not too far from it. Kaploop. It was pretty bad because there was another plane. It was a torpedo plane came by and dropped behind this guy when he was shot down. There was another one of them. They said they were float planes. I couldn't see them. I just saw dark things coming over, and the flames from the rear, from the motors. You know, this second plane, they was fired on, but he had already dropped his torpedo, and he didn't get knocked down, but it hit one of Dad's ships, same type of ship. A four stacker, and I saw that thing just blow up, and it was pretty bad. Yeah, there was a few of them. I guess a lot of them on that ship were killed. And my dad said, it wasn't his ship; it was one of his ships that was knocked down. So they lost a lot of that personnel. So and then after that, we went on up into Bougainville, and Dad got a shore boat to pick me up and take me to where I was. To be bivouacked on Bougainville, down the southern part of Bougainville. Mm-hmm. That's it for that day.
I can see why you haven't forgotten that day. That sounds pretty memorable. And now this is going to be just a series of islands that you're spending the next couple years of your life on. And your job there is to take care of Marines if they're wounded, right?
Absolutely, yes.
When did you have to start doing that?
Well, not for a while yet. After Bougainville, we came back to Guadalcanal, and we weren't there for more than a few weeks. And they said, we're getting aboard ship, we're going to on maneuver. So the whole bunch of us, part of the division, got on two or three ships, had to climb the rope ladder to get them on that. What an experience that is. You know, you look down, the water's a long way down below. So, You learn to grab the vertical rope and don't put your hands on the horizontal rope because somebody's going to step on you, you know. But anyway, we went to a couple of islands out while we were out. They said it was Iniwetok or Kwajalein, and we went ashore and they put some beer in a couple of shore boats, and we had a beer fest on the beach there, and it was hot. And there was a funny thing that happened. One of the guys found there's a certain kind of crab in those islands. It's got claws like you wouldn't believe, and it's a big crab. Anyway, he found a crab and he stuck his rifle down there to poke the crab, and the crab grabbed the sights on his rifle and bent the sights. Oh, those claws were like 6 or 8 inches long. So it wasn't bad, but he grabbed him, just pushed him. So he got rid of that. But that was a nice experience. You know, he had a break in routine and stuff. We got to go out and swim that day and enjoy a little food and the beer that they sent with for us too. So we got back aboard ship after that. And I guess we visited another island. They were, from what I can remember, they were just planning maneuvers or planning what to do in case of an invasion. That's all I could see. All we did was get aboard and sit and wait for something to happen, you know, back to Pinochle, you know. So anyway, then we went back to Guadalcanal, waited for something to happen. Then we loaded up after that. Wasn't more than 2 or 3 weeks, I guess. We load up and several ships, and we took off. Where we were going to go, we don't know. They wouldn't tell us, you know. We just going. And there was several troop ships. I would say at least 4 or 5. And so it was quite a trip from, I don't know how long, from there to the Marianas. That's where we went from there. And then they told us that we were back up for the next invasion. It was in for Saipan and Tinian in the Marianas. So we all were out on deck when we went up, and they dropped anchor out there. And we saw the other ships, not ships, but the LCV, please, landing ship dock, taking the Marines inshore to the, we were fairly close. We were within 200 or 300 yards at least of the coast, and all the LSTs were, LCVPs were getting together, and a big line of them went ashore, and we could saw what was happening, explosions, mortar fire, stuff like that. We were just sitting there, you know, are we going to go? And they said no, so we waited until dark, and they pulled up. We pulled up anchor, and then said we're going somewhere else. And I asked my captain, what are we going to do? He says, I don't know. He says, we have to get orders. So the next day, early, we were all, get your gear together. We're going ashore. And so we're getting ready, and all the shore boats were circling to pick us up. And so they came one by one, pick us up, and down the rope ladder we go again and get in the boats. And we went ashore, and as we're going ashore, we saw a lot of cannon fire. So anyway, we went into the beach, and ahead of me, there was a line of LCPBs that went into the beach first, and they were fired upon. I thought, well, we're going to get in that. But by the time we got in there, a lot of it had already moved inland. They pushed them inland, and there was mountain work that they were heading to go up over and around. And about that time, there was a lot of aircraft coming in, and they were shooting missiles into the refetments or the defensive places that the Japs had. So I watched a lot of that, and there was no fire by the time I got there. It was already moved inland, so we all had to dig foxholes waiting for the next thing to happen, which not much of it happened. It all went inland. So what they did, they set up the aid station, and I worked in the aid station for 2 or 3 days, and then they put me in grave registrations because I had the dental experience, and they needed somebody to identify undefiable personnel, which I worked at for a week or so until they used me for other things after that.
And I've talked to quite a few guys who had that kind of duty. Some of them only dealt with a few casualties, and some of them thousands. But how hard was that to carry out that duty, knowing this is a guy that could have been you?
Well, not fun, not fun at all. And the part about it was, that was about a week after we landed. They put me on registration, grave registration, where they were digging the grave sites and collecting body bags for them. And they were setting that all up, and I had half a dozen or a dozen undefiable, unidentifiable bodies, and I had to check their teeth, chart their teeth, which would be to the best of my ability. The bodies were in not good shape most of the time, and it was kind of gruesome and smelly, of course. You know, it's not fun. And so that's what I did. And I found out one of my buddies had been killed ahead of me. His name, Herb Clark, was a good friend of mine. And I didn't see his body or anything, but I found out it was him, and he'd already been buried. And in fact, he was buried before the graveyard was established. And they had to go out and dig him up and bring him up, and they knew who he was, and so I didn't have to identify him. In fact, I wrote a letter to his wife. Mm-hmm. I got a permission to do that, and I sent a you know, a letter of condolences, best as I could do, to help his wife understand that he did have friends out there. Later on, after the war, she contacted me, and I went out and met his wife and his mother and father. They, I understand later, they had his body reinterred from Guam and brought to the States, and he was reinterred in and around the Veterans Cemetery there in Westwood.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll ask you more about Herb Clark, because that really underscores all of this. So this is Guam, where you came ashore, and you're seeing what can happen. And then you lose one of your friends. You said a real good friend, Herb Clark. Is there something that you process yourself when that happens? That do you think any more about the possibility that you could be next?
Oh, I always thought that.
And Bill DeGeneres was not alone in thinking that. We have a lot more to cover with Bill, but unfortunately, we've run out of time on this edition of Hometown Heroes, so we're going to carry this conversation over into our next episode. We still need to hear about the rest of his experience in World War II, but also about his trip to Washington, D.C. decades later with Central Valley Honor Flight out of California, and why his art on the cover of a book he showed me in Rio Rancho, New Mexico, is also housed in the Smithsonian. Don't forget to check out the photos of Bill at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And join us again next time for the rest of his story, when we'll be reminded again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver. At ProvidentPayments.com.